From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Kayla DeRoche. Coming up this week, imitation crab has been in Alaska's seafood market for around 30 years. One food scientist is looking at ways to reduce the waste that's produced when it's made. Also, salmon conservation is a major concern in the state, and Alaskans are trying to brainstorm how to protect the fish and their habitat. That and more coming up on this week's Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
When people think of Alaska seafood, salmon and halibut usually come to mind. But the state also produces a lesser-known fish product sought after all around the world, surimi, the base for imitation crab. Now the guy who helped establish surimi in America more than 30 years ago is on a mission to improve how it's made. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
Tyree Lanier is a food scientist at North Carolina State University, where he's been since the 1970s. He has a background in the science of hot dogs, so working on seafood initially was a bit of a stretch for him.
I started off trying to make hot dogs out of fish, believe it or not, and then I heard about this product called surimi.
Or, as Lanier refers to it, the hot dog of the sea. For thousands of years, surimi seafood has been part of the Japanese cuisine. It comes in a variety of flavors and shapes.
There are forms that look like marshmallows. There are forms that look like noodles.
You probably know it as the fake crab meat in most California rolls. But until just a few decades ago, you could scarcely find surimi seafood in the United States. Lanier says there were a few reasons why early 80s America seemed ready to adopt a version of the food. One of them was the king crab fishery in Kodiak was on the verge of collapse, and the food industry was in a race to supply an alternative.
And so they said, okay, here's this imitation that looks very much and tastes very much like king crab. We can't get king crab. Let's bring this stuff from Japan and flood it into that market.
But there was also huge potential to produce surimi domestically from pollock in the Bering Sea. First, the state's fisheries would have to come on board. Lanier went to Alaska to talk about that possibility. Hot dog of the sea or not, surimi didn't get a warm reception.
It was basically like, what is that stuff? And we will never do that in the United States. And I knew that it was going to be done here because we were buying all this imitation crab and it was just taking off like a rocket.
Eventually, though, companies came around to Lanier's way of thinking, and the first surimi processor opened in Kodiak in 1985. And now, decades later, Lanier has another big idea for Alaska. He says surimi plants are losing profits down the drain, literally. Around 40% of the soluble protein from the surimi-making process winds up in the water.
Whether it's good or bad for the environment, I'm not qualified to say. But whether it's good or bad for food waste, it's terrible.
He says that wasted product could account for upwards of $60 million of savings each year. Then there's the impact on the ocean. According to Alaska Sea Grant, the surimi washwater can form an oxygen-depleted goo and smother marine life.
You can look at Google Earth and look down on the vicinity of any surimi plant, and some of these are quite large. And on a given day, if they've taken the picture right, you'll see a big white cloud in the water.
So to reduce waste, Lanier helped develop a technology to recapture the solids.
Well, imagine making cheese. Okay, you make cheese and you get curds and whey, like Little Miss Muffet. Well, we're doing exactly the same thing. We have basically surimi whey.
And that surimi whey can be turned into a lower-grade surimi product. He says the water that filters into the ocean would run crystal clear. Trident Seafoods has already shown interest. And Lanier thinks for surimi producers, this technology is a win-win.
It solves many problems, and it creates much more product for them. So now, from the same amount of fish, the same amount of money they've spent catching those fish, and they have a quota, so they can only catch so many fish, they can now make more product.
Lanier doesn't think that America's love affair with imitation crab will disappear anytime soon. And now there's a more efficient way of getting it to market. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
This year, as in previous years, the Kuskokwim River drainage will close to sport fishing for king salmon. The earlier closures were prompted by low king numbers, The Alaska Department of Fish and Game predicts another low return of king salmon along the river and is issuing regulations to conserve the species. To reduce incidental catch of kings, sports fishermen angling along the Kuskokwim River or its tributaries are restricted to using a single hook that's unbaited and has an artificial lure. If a king salmon is caught, the fishermen must release the king immediately without removing it from the water. People wanting to sport fish for king salmon will have to travel to Kuskokwim Bay rivers, where angling for kings remains open for now. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued these regulations in an emergency order in March. However, restrictions might relax if more king salmon than expected return. The regulations took effect May 1st and end on the last day of the sport fishing season on July 25th.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund, supporting conservation and harvesting of Alaska's wild, sustainable fisheries.
The Alaska Supreme Court heard arguments late last month in a case that will decide the fate of one of this year's most closely watched ballot initiatives. The Yes for Salmon initiative aims to toughen the permitting process for projects in salmon habitat. But the state of Alaska argues it goes against the state constitution. Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk was at the Alaska Supreme Court to hear lawyers from both sides argue their case. And she talked with Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend about what she heard.
So why is this case so important?
First off, this case is kind of a vehicle for a fight between industry groups and Alaska Native corporations and other folks who support resource development and folks who believe salmon habitat deserves more protection when people want to put in projects in the state. This case is really important because this will decide the fate of this ballot initiative, whether it ends up on the ballot, whether it doesn't, or if it ends up on the ballot changed in some form.
So what did you hear? What are some of the main arguments in the case?
First, I should say what they weren't arguing over. They weren't saying that this was whether this is good policy or not. This wasn't an argument over whether the Pebble Mine is a good idea or not. This wasn't an argument over whether this is overly burdensome for the industry. This wasn't just strictly over whether this is constitutional under the state constitution. And the specific provision they were arguing over is whether this is an unconstitutional provision of state assets, whether this would prevent the legislature from allowing a project in certain areas wholesale. And the supporters of the ballot initiative say this gives the legislature some wiggle room. They can decide to allow a big mine. It just increases the protections that the state has. The state disagrees. The state thinks that this would completely prevent certain projects, and so it doesn't follow the state constitution.
How about the justices? What was the reaction from the Alaska Supreme Court justices? And did you pick up any cues on how they're leaning?
I can't say whether they are, you know, what they're going to say, but one thing they really focused on and asked a lot of questions about was whether they can take out certain parts of this ballot initiative and still send it in, like, and make it be okay under the state constitution and still send it to the ballot, whether that would preserve kind of the heart and soul of this ballot initiative if they were to do that, or if by doing that they would really be changing what all the signatories in this ballot initiative wanted when they signed on to this initiative. So they asked a lot of questions about that. When I talked to the initiative supporters, you know, they want the initiative to kind of go on the ballot as it's written now, but they indicated that it would be okay with them if the Supreme Court took out kind of the most prescriptive lines in this initiative and left the rest of it as is.
That was Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk speaking with Lori Townsend about the Yes for Salmon initiative. A group of 16 people from around the state gathered in Petersburg for 5 days talking and learning about salmon. They are part of a salmon-centered fellowship with the Alaska Humanities Forum. As KFSK's Angela Denning reports, they're trying to find new ways to keep Alaska salmon sustainable.
Alaska is a huge state with a lot of varying opinions about a lot of different things. But one thing that most people have in common is salmon. It touches almost everyone's life.
Salmon is a defining factor in the culture of Alaska.
Cameron Perez-Verdia is the president of the Alaska Humanities Forum. He says while salmon is important to many Alaskans, it also comes with very different viewpoints.
It's a flashpoint of conflict over a lot of difficult issues that we have in Alaska, racial justice and the urban-rural divide and balancing sustainability against the needs of resource development.
There are many Alaskans interested in harvesting salmon, but there are only so many to go around, particularly king salmon. And science has only come up with so many answers as to why their populations have been declining. Perez-Verdia says the Alaska Humanities Forum sees it as salmon have a people problem, and in order to find solutions, they need to call on the state's differing voices to come together. A few years back, they created the Salmon Fellowship to grow a network of people from around the state to talk about it. There are two cohorts of 16 fellows each, selected from dozens of applicants from all over the state. Petersburg's gathering is the very first time the fellows in the second cohort are meeting each other. Perez-Verdia says it's a very diverse group of people.
Diverse in terms of where they're from, diverse areas that they might work in, for instance, sport or commercial or subsistence or policy. It's really an effort to bring really very different people together to build a cohort and to think creatively and innovatively about the salmon challenges that we have in Alaska and to ultimately develop projects that can impact that system in a positive way.
The fellows spend a lot of time together. Each term lasts 18 months. During that time, the group meets in person four times for five-day gatherings. Petersburg resident Chris Norris is part of the first group of fellows. She's been in the seafood industry for about 40 years. Her fellowship wraps up in October, but she believes that the network the process created will continue in the future.
For me, it just comes down to trying to solve problems. We can't do it in a vacuum. You know, here's people where you have this common goal of sustainability of salmon.
She says it's easy for people to get divisive when it comes to salmon. But listening and trying to understand different perspectives will be key to creating solutions.
It's hard to argue with someone's experience because they own that. And so, you know, when you get to know someone and you hear about their experiences, it lends itself to a softer conversation instead of people trying to think in a meeting right away, okay, what's my comeback going to be? How am I going to defend my sector?
People like to say that Petersburg is the town that fish built. Commercial fishermen harvest millions of pounds of pink salmon every year, as well as other salmon species. Perez-Verdia says when traveling to places like Petersburg, the fellows get an immersion experience.
To connect with community, to talk with industry, to really make sure that their learning and their development is connected to real people in real life. And we're not sitting in some classroom somewhere, but we're outside talking to people. We're in businesses. We're in people's homes, and we're really learning about what's going on in Alaska.
And with time, he says, hopefully the fellows can help Alaskans come up with new and innovative solutions to keeping salmon sustainable. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
And that's all for this week's Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KFSK's Angela Denning in Petersburg, the Alaska Energy Desk's Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend in Anchorage. From KMXT in Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.